Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everyone, welcome back to Regular Cherry Bomb. We're the show that's all about girl power and food. Our guest today is Jordan Salcido. She's the beverage director for the Momofuku Restaurant Group and also the founder of her own wine label, Bellis Wines. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you, Claudia. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, please. Jordan was also one of our ones to watch in the very first issue of Cherry Bomb. So it's fun to have you back and catch up, you know, see what you're up to these days. So I was talking to you earlier, and you have been studying for this Master Sommelier.
Yes. Okay.
Thing.
Yes. So they have this exam once a year, and the way that it works is you have three. So once you pass any single part of it, you have a total of 3 years to try and pass all three of those parts. Otherwise, you reset and you lose the parts that you've passed. So I I guess I took it first in 2013. And I passed the blind tasting part right away, which was nice. So there are three parts to the blind tasting exam, where you have 25 minutes to identify six wines blind. So three
That's crazy.
White wines and three reds. And it really is a muscle. I can talk about that more later on, but it's like the best example of practice results in... Yeah, practice has results, I guess.
What do you have to... identify in the blind taste? Is it like the grape
yes.
and the region?
It is the grape and the region and the country, and then you also need to walk through your process. So it's sort of like you can't just accidentally land on the six.
No lucky answers, no guesses.
No guesses, and that is one of the most difficult parts initially, but then it becomes the thing that helps everything else make sense. And the way that was best explained to me was by a mentor, a man named Jay Fletcher. He lives in Colorado in Aspen, at the base of Aspen Mountain. He's this wonderful taster, and he's also a wonderful teacher. And his whole thing is that blind tasting is a game of logic. And so basically what you're doing is you're looking for clues in the glass. And you might not get those clues initially, but every grape has a profile. And every wine has a profile. So you're sort of walking through all the clues that you get from what you see in the glass to the color and to the, you know, sometimes people swirl around a glass and they look for the legs. What does that tell you? That basically just tells you viscosity, which comes from either sugar in the wine or alcohol. So you know that either it's a sweet wine and that's coming from sugar, or you know that it's alcohol, which means it's coming from a warm region. Or was picked really late, but usually it's from a warm region. So just little clues like that start to add up. Then when you're smelling, you can get sort of different sorts of aromas from every different wine. Like you'll know if you're smelling lemon and lime, it's probably a wine that's going to have a lot of acidity in it and be from a cool climate or a cool region. And then if your citrus is more like orange or tangerine and more tropical notes, you can identify that it's probably from a warmer place. So basically you're just adding up 50 tiny little clues along the way. And then when you get to the end, you say, all right, you know, this is a wine. Like I'll just take Cabernet, for example. You know, Cabernet Sauvignon. All right, so it's going to be a wine that has high tannin. It's the only wine with high tannin that does not have high acid. Of course, that's red. We're just talking about red grapes here. But the three grapes that have high tannin are Nebbiolo and Sangiovese, two Italian grapes that also have high acidity and usually high alcohol, whereas Cabernet Sauvignon is high tannin, with like medium or medium plus acidity. And so it's just basically, it really just comes from giving yourself these reference points. And the more reference points you have, the more you can just sort of pinpoint like, all right, this is not high acid. And all right, this is, it just all starts to come together. And then you, at the end of the glass, you've sort of walked yourself through this logical journey and you come to a conclusion and you have to double check yourself and make sure that all the things that you called actually lead up to a path that results in Cabernet Sauvignon from the Napa Valley. You also have to get vintage correct.
So the year.
The year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would probably be able to get red or white or bubbly.
You need so much better than you're letting on. And it really is one of those things where, you know, you just do it for a little while and then you get so much better at
it. Yeah. How many wines do you have to taste be able to like...
Let's see. Well, and I guess I should also qualify. It doesn't like Brazilian wines are not part of this.
Okay, so they don't try and throw you like a curveball.
No.
Okay,
like a curveball would be like a Certico from Santorini, and that's definitely would be a curveball. But it's sort of like they want you to understand the major regions, the major countries, the major grapes, and have a solid understanding of that.
Okay, so what's the next part that you have to pass?
Okay, so the other two parts, let's see, there's the theory exam, which so I guess in order to get to the Master Sommelier exam, you have to pass these three other exams throughout various points. And there are usually these three different sections. They just keep getting harder. So at the master level, you have about 100 questions, and they're asked orally across a table, so you're not writing them down, and it's not multiple choice. You are across the table from two or three different masters, and they are asking you questions, and you have about 30 seconds to answer each question. And
what's a sample question?
One sample question was like, all right, let's think. One was like, why are barrels in Sanlúcar de Barrameda topped up more frequently than barrels in Jerez? So you have to know that you're in Sherry. You have to know that you're talking about two different towns in Sherry. You have to know which one's closer to the ocean, which is Sanlúcar de Barrameda, which is basically right on the ocean. And then you have to know the impact of these different winds. So there are these two winds in Sherry.
You're like a climatologist.
Well, that's the thing about wine that like keeps me so interested is like, it's all these things, right? It's like geography and anthropology and philosophy and history and all these things all sort of come together in this one bottle of wine. You have the dry wind, and that's the Levant, and then you have the very humid wind, the Poniente, and so sort of it's like the balance of when one's in and the other's out, then the humidity fluctuates, and you have to top up according to the humidity.
God. And the last section of this very difficult test is?
So, and that's the section that I have not passed yet. So I passed the first two, which was really...
Congratulations.
Thank you. And then the part that I have not passed is the service exam, which is... It's interesting because I work service every night at Co, or Momofuku Co, and I have worked service for a really long time, and so I sort of didn't study as much for that part. I did study, of course, but so much of what service is supposed to be is sort of like, hey, now you have this tasting experience, now you have this theory, this understanding of how the world of wine fits together. How do you do that in an exam setting? And the exam is not like a normal night of service. I like to compare it to a service obstacle course. So you're timed and you have the most difficult guests at every table, and everyone's upset and everyone's angry and everyone's trying to sort of like redirect you so that you lose track of time, that you run out of time, that you go off on a goose chase instead of like handling the matter at hand. There are a couple of other things that, you know, if you're decanting a bottle and you forget to present it, then that's a fail. Or if you look up when you're decanting, then that's an automatic fail.
Oh my gosh.
Because you could have a bunch of sediment that goes into the decanter and that defeats your whole point. Or there's a champagne table. So I guess this last time, It sounds like I passed two of the three tables, the decanting table, which was nice. And then there's always like another kind of table where it ranges from blind smelling spirits or wines or anything, beers, sakes, it can be anything, correcting wine lists, all of this sort of thing. So definitely, they do a very good job of making it very all-encompassing. So.
I mean, it's definitely not an easy test to pass. I think there are only like 230-something master sommeliers in the world.
I believe so. I want to say it's even less than that, and I think it's around 30 are women.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is, for me, the thing that keeps me like inspired to keep trying for this, because they only offer it once a year, and you know, it takes a lot of time to study for it and all that, but sort of like... And at this point, it's just a goal, and I think it's a really great organization in terms of education. They really focus on that, and so I feel like even though I did not pass this last time, I feel like I'm better at my job as a result of studying and trying for it. So,
yeah. So let's talk about your day job at Momofuku Restaurant Group. You basically take care of the wine list for Mapesh, Sambar, Noodle Bar, and Momofuku Co. And all of them have different wines. So I kind of wanted to pick your brain and ask you, how do you come up with a wine list for a restaurant?
Oh, totally. And I should also say that I get to work with such an amazing team. So it's definitely, for sure, a team effort. Let's see. I guess the two that we sort of have revised or that we like put the most focus on most recently, we did, I guess maybe I'll do a little overview of the four different ones. All right, so at Noodle Bar, we thought it would be fun to go either big or small. So we got rid of regular sized bottles, and we added a few half bottles for, you know, that wine person who's like, I need a great bottle of wine with my pork bun, but usually you're in and out and you're not there for a long time, so you don't need a whole bottle, you just need a great half bottle. And then we got rid of regular sized bottles and instead started pouring all of our glasses out of Magnum and started to offer Magnums as well, because a lot of times people will come in and they'll get the fried chicken, which is so great. And so we're like, all right, we want some champagne on here. We need like a Magnum of Savart champagne that people can just order, and we'll make it like a really, we'll make it like a very reasonable priced Magnum of champagne.
So you'll pour a single glasses of wine out of a Magnum and just keep it open?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The champagne is the one exception. That's the one where you have to buy the whole bottle, but all of the glasses, so if you get a glass of rosé or a glass of white wine or red wine, everything comes out of a large format.
What's the advantage of that for the restaurant?
Yeah, great question. Okay, so basically you have a better, two things. You have a smaller air to wine ratio because your bottle is twice the size of a regular bottle, but the cork is the same size. So the same amount of air comes in, and basically it results in like a longer development period and a more gentle development period. So it's great for aging wine, and also and then it's also environmentally a little bit better because you're only using one label and one cork and that sort of thing.
Mapesh, how did you come up with
Mapesh,
that?
Okay, all right. So Mapesh, I would say we basically decided that in Mapesh or at Mapesh, you have these like, you have a lot of diehard Momofuku fans that are really curious and they want to try new things all the time. But you're also in Midtown, which is such a more traditional neighborhood. But we started looking at history and we're like, you know what? It wasn't always a more traditional neighborhood. You have like the Algonquin Round Table, and you Midtown used to be this hotbed of creativity and collaboration and experimentation. So we wanted to take that idea and also the needs of and the interests of our guests, and we decided to sort of make a two-part wine list. So one part, we decided that we would make that be the 56 selection. So it's 56 wines that all cost $56 each, and the one theme that those have in common are that they are off the beaten path. So those are, hey, I'm willing to experiment. You know, you're not going to find your Chablis there, or your Oregon Pinot Noir. unless they're doing something really crazy and different. And so they're all wines that, you know, we spend a lot of time tasting and making sure that we love them and that they are yummy with the food and all of that. But that's the sort of more experimental idea right there. And then the rest of the list we've organized by region, and that's where we have like the benchmark. So that's where we'll have our Barolos and our Brunellos or our Rosso del Montalcino and the Burgundies and the Napa Valley wines and that sort of thing. So much more traditional.
Classics.
Uh-huh. And there are very different parts of the list. So if you know that you, if you know that you are out for an adventure, then the 56 selections is sort of the direction that people seem to have a lot of fun with. And then a lot of times people are coming in for a business meeting and they are not in the mood to experiment. They're like, we want something great that we can drink five bottles of throughout the course of our meal and not ask any questions about. So
right. Okay. Sambar?
Sambar. Okay. So Sambar, we're actually in the process of sort of like switching up a little bit. But the thing that we keep talking about and coming back to and that we have done so far at Sambar is we wanted to make sure that it's like best of. So everything is a best of, whether it's quirky or whether it's traditional. So we have like a lot of wines that, you know, we'll get like four bottles a year for the whole restaurant group. And like, we definitely want to showcase that on Sambar because it's a restaurant that has its foundation in being like the great, great, great food, but in a casual environment. So we just wanted to make sure that we are able to channel that with wine too. So we're like, all right, different price points all over the map, but great wines that we really stand behind and are so, and like we want to be excited and have something amazing to say about every single bottle, which is also true of Co and Noodle Bar and Ma Pesh, but it's, I guess, in a more casual way. So that's the list that's paper. And you just, it's one piece of paper that folds forward and backwards. And it's much more concise than either the Ma Pesh list or the Co list, which are in multiple pages and that sort of thing. So similar philosophy, but different organization.
And so the Co list is the one that Momofuku Co just moved to a new place last winter,
yes.
I think. And so you kind of did something experimental with this wine list. And it's more, I guess, based around social media, I hear.
So what we decided to do, and there was we got a very, very kind write-up from Levy Dalton maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was very, very kind, and he likened it to social media, which I love. That was definitely not how the idea started. Basically, what we did is we added photographs. And the reason why, we added photographs, and initially, you know, for me, it was sort of like, hey, what I'm always trying to think about is like, how can we make somebody's experience with wine the best possible? And it means different things in different restaurants. But at a place like Co, which we had talked about for a really long time, Co at Momofuku is like very, very curated, right? Like you go in and your menu has been curated for you and it's very organized and it's a lot of different options, but it's always the best of whatever they're able to produce on that given day. So from a wine perspective, we're like, okay, we're going to have, this is going to be a wine list that's about benchmarks. But also, benchmarks means different things. And the thing about wine that's so, one of the many things about wine that's so exciting for me is that it's always changing. And philosophy is such a common thread. But like, I guess you can make the analogy in any industry. If you have like a painter, then that painter usually studied under another painter or became friends with this other painter. And then these influences like encourage and inspire a new medium for greatness. So with wine, we're sort of like, okay, let's start with some of our favorite producers, some of the known greats, but then let's also track like who works with who and who inspired who and like how did this person become great. So like I'll talk about our champagne section. We have the first producer listed is a man named Anselm Solos, and he makes wine at a domaine Jacques Solos, named after his father. And he is responsible and credited with really starting what we now call today the grower champagne method, or movement rather, where instead of like the big houses that also make beautiful wine, but that more channel a house style where they're sort of blending from different vintages and different vineyards to make one style that's more consistent over time. Jacques Solos was like, no, or Anselm Solos was like, no, you know, it's all about place and it's all about like farming organically and taking care of the land. And if you start researching him, he happened to go to Burgundy. So he went to Burgundy and he studied with three of the great Burgundy producers, Domaine Comblafon, and who else? Comblafon, Cochetery, and N. Claude Lefebvre. And then he came back from those studies and his mind was just looking at opportunity to make champagne in a different way. And then that led to these other people that he worked with that made their first champagnes in his cellar, like Jérôme Prévost or Charton, Alexandre Charton-Taillé. And like there are all these guys who are now like the new generation of these rock stars in champagne that wouldn't have maybe had the ability to sort of think this way had it not been for Anselm Solos, who might not have thought that way had he not gone to Burgundy to see their philosophy. And so it's sort of all about connection. And so rather than like write a big paragraph, because we sort of thought, you know what, people put big paragraphs in wine books and that's great, but so many times it just seems like our attention span is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So rather than do that, or rather than me try to write something that's going to be less interesting than maybe what, you know, the seminal book on the region is going to say, what if we just helped connect those dots? Because those dots are for me what makes the story come alive and what places every single bottle in a certain context. So that was the idea behind the list.
Wow, my head is spinning right now. But we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more Jordan. We're back with Jordan Salcido. I wanted to ask you why you decided to start your own wine label. It's called Bellis Wines, and it's all organic, all sustainably farmed grapes, and you give part of your proceeds back to charity.
Yes. Okay, so this idea, I guess the idea for Bellis happened when I was working at 11 Madison Park, and it was just about the time that I started getting a little tiny bit of a life back, you know, because you work a long time in restaurants and, you know, your days go from, at some point they go from like 17 hours a day to like 10 or 12. And so I started hanging out with some non-industry girlfriends who were doing things like getting their MBA from Stanford, or, you know, just these really smart, wonderful women, and they were so intimidated by wine, and they were like not sure how to look for wine or what to buy or how to ask for what they wanted. And it just, I guess there are two pieces of this answer, and the first thing was just feeling like there had to be a better way of there had to be a better way of creating something or helping people like my friends who were very smart and curious people find what they liked aside from reading Robert Parker's Points or that sort of thing. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was that, I guess starting in 2006, I started working Harvest in Burgundy. And then starting in 2008 in Italy as well. And so Just having that connection to the process of making wine and realizing that wine is not all made the same way. You know, there's a reason why different wines are priced differently, and the great wines of the world tend to be grown organically, whether or not they are advertised that way. And then you have your really amazing value wines that are like $2 or $3. We won't name names, but those are usually produced in a very different kind of way, where not only are you machine harvesting and you're not farming organically, but when those grapes get to the winery, they're adding all sorts of crazy things like Velcorin and powdered tannin and mega purple and all these things.
Yum.
All these crazy chemicals. So it's sort of like, I don't want that. And I don't want people that I know and love who I know care about things like eating an organic tomato or caring where their food comes from to be drinking wine that is totally opposite of that. And I had the opportunity to start working with some wine at a winery in Italy, in Montalcino in Tuscany, because a friend of mine owned that winery and he only wanted to work with certain grapes, not the others. So it was sort of like, okay, I know exactly how these grapes are grown because I have helped with this whole thing. And this seems like a good organic way to start this project. And one thing that all of our bottles have is this term, this little chart that my mom came up with a name for called the palate table. And it's sort of like a little Consumer Reports chart that just talks about, it's like five circles means the most and zero of five means there's none of that thing. But all those words that sort of help make a wine what it is, sort of like in blind tasting, it's like, you know, the clues, like what are the clues that lead to the grape? So we chart out acidity, body, tannin, minerality, and oak. So every bottle of wine shows how much or how little of that element of wine is, or how much of that element is in the wine, so that hopefully it starts to make people feel more comfortable identifying what they like or what they don't like.
Yeah, it's like a language that, like a vocabulary talking about wines.
Totally, exactly. And I guess as I was thinking about it, it was sort of like, well, what would I want? Like if I were just learning about wine, what would I want in a wine? Okay, I would want it to not be, you know, sure, sometimes you can splurge on a special bottle, but, you know, my income was not at the point at that moment in my life where I could spend more than really $20 or so a bottle. So that tends to be the sort of general price point of most of the wines, and we're working on some and others that may be a little bit different, but in general, something that's not your $200 bottle or your,
right.
It's not your cult wine that you only save for special occasions. It's meant to be something that you can drink.
So can anyone have their own wine label, or is it really difficult?
Well, let's see. I think I was really lucky because of friendships that I had been able to make while working in the industry. But I think, I mean, there are lots of little steps along the way, right?
Yes, yes.
So it's like you have to first, I think the hard thing is always like figuring out grapes that you want to work with, and then having a winery partner. So initially when we started this, I was not working in restaurants as much at all. And so after 11 Madison, I took some time off to really focus on Bellis. And then, you know, a few years went by and I realized, you know, especially working with Momofuku, and you just can't go over to Italy
right.
six times
knock on someone's door right. and be like, hey, make me some wine.
You really have to trust the people that you're working with and have a solid foundation with them. And have access to great vineyards that you believe in. So I would say that I've been very lucky. But I think anything is possible if that's what you decide.
If you're
to want.
Determined,
if you are
like
determined,
you can do anything
exactly.
if you really want it, right?
Exactly.
So what wines are you into right now?
Oh, okay, like summertime wines?
Yeah, summer.
All right, okay.
We're in the height of summer,
In the height of summer. All right, so a wine that I've been obsessed with for a while, that I'm very excited because we're going to make a domestic version of and release it, I guess, next year. But Bougie Sardon is the French appellation. So it's sparkling, it's pink, and it is slightly off dry. And it is so refreshing. It sort of tastes like fresh watermelon and fresh strawberries and a little squeeze of tart cherry with like some little fresh basil maybe. It's just refreshing and delicious, and it's not too high in alcohol, so you can drink it at the beach and all day at lunch and into dinner if you want. But definitely not your most serious wine maybe, but a really good one for summer. Chablis is like such a good go-to summer wine for me. And there's a new producer called, it's two words, Eleni and Edouard Vaucare. And they are making gorgeous wines, tiny, tiny production. And this is their first year being imported into the U.S. And we actually just got the wine in at Co. We're pouring it at Co right now by the glass. So you can come in and have a glass if you want to try it. But yeah, Chablis is like the northernmost region of Burgundy. The grape is Chardonnay, but it doesn't taste like any other Chardonnay that you've had, because it's grown on this very, very chalky soil, and then usually, you know, no one's using new oak, so you just have very pure wine. It's very, very clean, very pure, very bright, very yummy.
So when I'm totally not a wine expert, but when I go into a wine store, I think my mind goes blank and I don't know where to look. Do you have any tips about going into a store and picking out a good wine? Because I usually just pick wines by how I like the label. Like, if the label's nice, I'll be like, yeah, it must be good.
I love that, because your sense of design is so on point.
Yeah, but maybe it's not the best way to go into a wine store.
Okay, all right. So I would say the first thing to do is think about, so maybe let's go through three terms, and then, because the thing is, there are going to be different right bottles depending on your mood and what you want and what the day is like and what you're eating and all those things. So if you want something, all right, so we'll talk about the three major terms that I think, if you can like get your head around these, it just makes everything so much easier. So acidity, body, and tannin. There are other things too, but we'll go through those three. So acidity is basically like tartness or sourness, but it's freshness in a wine. So you know, the word acidity maybe doesn't sound very appetizing, but basically any refreshing wine has a lot of acidity or brightness, and you feel acidity along the sides of your palate. And that's where, I guess, going back to that like citrus analogy, think about if you want like something that's high acidity, like lemons or limes, like a margarita is like a high acidity drink, whereas like, I guess, something with no acidity would be like a Manhattan, where you just have none of that at all. But so acidity is one thing, and some people love it and some people don't. And the grapes that have a lot of acidity in them, I guess the way that acidity manifests itself is, if you're getting a wine from a cool climate, there's just not enough sunshine to really ripen it and give it too much sugar. So anything in like the Loire Valley is going to be pretty refreshing and bright in acidity. Anything in northern France, so Burgundy, even like Alsace, sometimes you'll have like more weight and body, but you still have really good acidity there. Northern Italy, any of those cool
German wines.
Yeah, German wines, of course. Yes, yes, yes. Like that's like the apex of acidity, right? Like German Riesling. So that's one thing. Then you have body, and think of body in terms of, I know nobody drinks milk anymore, but if you can remember, like whole milk versus skim milk versus like half and half or cream, or even, I guess, like hemp milk versus like light almond milk or
coconut milk.
Coconut milk, yeah, totally.
Compared to coconut water.
totally. So like, right. So I feel like almond milk, like that sort of insipid almond milk that's not like your high quality stuff, that's like, or like your skim milk, and that's like light in body, right? It just sort of like doesn't really make an impact. And that's something that is really useful if you're having a dish or a meal that's really light in body. So you're having flu crudo, or it's salad, or it's lunch, or whatever. So as opposed to something full in body. So that would be something like, all right, so that's your like coconut milk slash your whole milk or your cream. And then in a wine standpoint, that's going to be from a warmer region. So something like, if you're in France, like the Northern Rhone, if you're in California, something like a Napa Chardonnay, maybe. In Alsace, that's going to be like your Gewürztraminer or your Pinot Gris. And, so let's see. So that's body. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Okay. And then And you would want something with fuller body if you're having more fuller-bodied food. So, or if you just want that kind of wine. I'm sort of drawing wine pairing references, but the main rule of wine pairing is if you know that you like something and that's what you want to drink, just drink that.
Yeah. Who cares what the food is?
Totally. And if you do want to go for a pairing thing, then there's definitely a lot to be said about that. But it's not rules you have to follow unless you sort of want to get into that. Let's see. And so a full-bodied wine would be great with, like, cheeses or charcuterie or that sort of thing. And so, let's see. And then tannin is the other thing. So tannin really mostly just applies to red wines. But you have your very light tannin wines. And these are, like, for me, that's like your summer red wines. So that's like your Beaujolais, like your Cru Beaujolais. So you have these 10 villages in Beaujolais. So if you're asking for wine or for Beaujolais in a store, ask for Cru Beaujolais because it's always higher quality, and the people who make wine from there and care to label it as such tend to just care more about what they're doing in general. So that's going to be very fruity, very fresh, very low in tannin. And tannin, think of like a tea bag that you've oversteeped. So like high tannin would be like you left your green tea bag in your tea for an hour and you forgot to remove it. And then there's sort of like that sandpaper feeling, mm-hmm. as opposed to none of that sandpaper feeling and then everything in between. So high tannin would be like lots of like grippiness, and then low tannin would be none of that at all, and then medium tannin would be sort of in the middle. And in general, the highest tannin wines tend to be either Cabernet Sauvignon or your wines from Italy. They tend to have your red wines from Italy, so your Sangiovese, your Nebbiolo, your Aglianico. And tannins can be really, really beautiful, but the way that that they sort of tend to behave best is if you give them some time to soften. So what happens is, like, this is maybe getting too geeky, but think of tannins as like links in a chain link fence, and you like the part that you feel on your palate are like the two ends of those chains in the chain link fence, and the more time goes on, those tannins actually polymerize. They like sort of link together like magnets, and then you only feel the sort of like sticky end of one end of the chain and the other. And so instead, it's just very soft. So you can like have a high tannin grape that is softened with time and very gentle. But for our purposes, let's say everything in your wine store is young and new. When would you ever want a high tannin wine? That's maybe when you're having like a steak or something that really like something really, really fatty, even like big. Yeah, anything really fatty that can sort of absorb all that like tannin, those tannins, then that's one thing to sort of look for. But then you have wines with like a little bit of tannin, like Pinot Noir or Syrah. So that's sort of medium tannin range, and that would be good for your roast chicken or your sort of like, yeah, anything that isn't as extreme.
So how long do you suggest decanting wines?
Ooh, okay. So like in advance?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It really, it totally depends on the bottle.
On the bottle.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
And also it depends on why you're decanting it. So if it's a young wine without a lot of sediment, then usually you would want, the reason to decant that wine would be to give it oxygen, which is the same thing. So like, that's basically you're accomplishing the same task as cellaring it for a long time, because the only thing that time in a bottle does is it releases more oxygen, right? So basically the reason to decant something young would be to give it more oxygen, to help it develop more quickly, and to help it open up. In which case, anything that's like a high tannin wine that you would normally want to like be able to age for 10 years, I would decant that as early as possible, you know, maybe even like an hour or two in advance, as opposed to something like a Pinot Noir from Burgundy, where you're sort of, the thing you don't want to do is like have all of your aromas open up in your decanter instead of your glass. So I don't decant young wines all that often these days, unless it's Burgundy, because I feel like sometimes that it can help open up those aromas.
The flavors, yeah.
Yeah, just really right before serving.
Wow. Well, I've definitely learned that I need to know more about wine.
I don't know if these answers are helping or not.
No, but I feel like, you know, I feel now a little bit better about going into a wine store.
Okay,
which
good.
Is great.
Okay, good.
But yeah, thank you, Jordan, for being on the show and imparting some of your knowledge on us.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Of course.
I love the magazine so much, and I love the Jubilee so much, and I love what you guys do.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. Radio Cherry Bomb is a co-production of Heritage Radio Network and Cherry Bomb Magazine. If you want to know more or you want to subscribe, go to cherrybomb.com. And I'm going to leave you with a quote from Joan Collins, who said, "Age is just a number. It's totally irrelevant unless, of course, you happen to be a bottle of wine." Thanks for listening.
Love that.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.